Dawn Recorded Lecture Service is pleased to present a session from the 1998 General Convention held at the University of Pittsburgh at Johnstown, Pennsylvania. The speaker for this session is Brother James Parkinson, whose subject is Lessons from Deborah and Gideon.
We'll discuss a little bit, sort of in study format, Lessons from Deborah and Gideon. This time when they were active is the high point in Israel's history of the judges. After Joshua died, this was the greatest point until we get to the time of David. First we look at what was it that happened, and then how did it happen, because sometimes it seems that the detail hasn't been written out. And then, more important still, what should we learn from these things? Now, Deborah will show us more things in connection with heaven's role, whereas with Gideon, we tend to look at what on earth happened, or as we project it down to the end of this age, what on earth will happen. Now, there are lessons there about others, and there are lessons for us. As we go through it, think like this. You are there when it happened. What would you do under the circumstance? Then think, what if I were there, an Israelite, and I had not followed instructions? What would happen? That's something that's pretty missing in the 1990s, isn't it? Oh, Dad, this is the 90s. How many people even know how to follow instructions? And then one more thing that we commonly don't look at. What about the Ephraimites? What happened to them? The younger son of Joseph, who was given the greater of Joseph's inheritance. What happened to them? What's the lesson for us? We'll begin by reading in Judges chapter 4. I think we'll read about the first six verses for now. This will be from the American Standard Version, but King James will be pretty close. New American Standard Bible will too. Judges 4, beginning with the first verse. And the children of Israel again did that which was evil in the sight of the Lord, when Ehud was dead. And the Lord sold them into the hand of Jabin, king of Canaan, that reigned in Hazor, Hatzor, whatever pronunciation you like, it's fine, same place. The captain of whose host was Sisera, who dwelt in Harosheth of the Gentiles. And the children of Israel cried unto the Lord, for he had 900 chariots of iron. And 20 years he mightily oppressed the children of Israel. Now Deborah, a prophetess, the wife of Lapidoth, she judged Israel at that time. And she dwelt under the palm tree of Deborah between Ramah and Bethel, in the hill country of Ephraim. And the children of Israel came up to her for judgment. By judgment there we mean the oppressed asking relief from the oppressor. And she sent and called Barak, the son of Abinoam, out of Kedesh Naphtali, and said to him, Hath not the Lord, the God of Israel, commanded, saying, Go and draw unto Mount Tabor, and take with thee 10,000 men of the children of Naphtali and the children of Zebulun. And we'll continue. I will draw unto thee to the river Kishon Sisera, the captain of Jabin's army, with his chariots and his multitude, and I will deliver him into thy hand. And Barak said unto her, If thou wilt go with me, then I will go. But if thou wilt not go with me, I will not go. And she said, I will surely go with thee. Notwithstanding, the journey that thou takest shall not be for thine honor. For the Lord will sell Sisera into the hand of a woman. And Deborah arose and went with Barak to Kedesh. And Barak called Zebulun and Naphtali together. He didn't call Ephraim or the other tribes, but he called his own tribe and another one, Zebulun and Naphtali, together to Kedesh. And there went up 10,000 men at his feet, and Deborah went up with him. We'll skip the 11th verse. It simply tells about Heber being in alliance with the bad guys. And the 12th verse, And they told Sisera that Barak, the son of Abinoam, was gone up to Mount Tabor. And Sisera gathered together all his chariots, even 900 chariots of iron, and all the people that were with him from Harosheth of the Gentiles under the river Kishon. In those days, the great armies consisted of foot soldiers and archers, and the ones that were particularly wealthy, they had chariots as well. And Deborah said unto Barak, Up, or get up, for this is the day in which the Lord hath delivered Sisera into thy hand. Is not the Lord gone out from before thee? So Barak went down from Mount Tabor, and 10,000 men after him. And the Lord discomfited Sisera and all his chariots and all his host with the edge of the sword before Barak. And Sisera alighted from his chariot and fled away on his feet. But Barak pursued after the chariots and after the host unto Harosheth of the Gentiles, and all the host of Sisera fell by the edge of the sword, and there was not a man left. And then it tells about Sisera going another direction. The ones that were trying to escape mostly went back westward to where they had come from. But to get away, he goes northward and tries to hide with whom he thinks is still his allies. And, he comes to the wife of Heber, and she says, Okay, you can go into my tent. Well, of course, that's something that a man has no business doing, except for her husband. And so he says, Now, just if anybody comes, you say, There's nobody here. Well, she gives him some warm milk to drink. That helps to put him to sleep. And then she assisted further with a tent peg. And so Sisera was now history. It doesn't give us much detail as to how the Lord discomfited Sisera in the 15th verse. But we can get some idea of the battle from the next chapter. This is where Deborah sings a song. Now, until we get perhaps to King David, we don't have very many songs recorded, but we have a few. There was one by Miriam, and here's another one by Deborah. And we learn a few things in the fifth chapter in this song that we didn't get from just the brief historical account. We come to verse 1 and 2. Then sang Deborah and Barak, the son of Abinoam, on that day, saying, For that the leaders took the lead in Israel, for that the people offered themselves willingly, bless ye the Lord. Does that sound like us? The people offered themselves willingly. Even that is not the question. Does that sound like me? That is the question for each of us. Verses 4 and 5. Lord, when thou wentest forth out of Seir, Now, Seir is way down to the southeast, perhaps south-southeast, of where this is taking place. When thou marchedst out of the field of Edom. Yep, that's south-southeast again. That's like southeast corner of the Dead Sea and still farther south. The earth trembled, like Parkinson's disease, you know. And the heavens also dropped. Yea, the clouds dropped water. Here we have part of a clue as to what it was that was going on, how the Lord discomfited Sisera. In the 19th verse, the kings came and fought. Then fought the kings of Canaan in Tanakh by the waters of Megiddo. That's down to the south part of the great valley of Esdraelon, or plain, the largest plain in Israel and largest inland plain. Verse 20, from heaven fought the stars. From their courses they fought against Sisera. The river Kishon swept them away. That ancient river, the river Kishon, O my soul, march on with strength. Now we get an idea as what's happening here. The earth trembled, the heavens also dropped. Yea, the clouds dropped water. All right, now, Barak, let's kind of get an idea of this. We've got this great plain of Esdraelon here stretching from the west to the east. Actually, we might say sort of west-northwest to the east-southeast. And that would be, I guess, tilted that way for everyone there. And down to the south, we have Mount Carmel, the Mount Carmel range. And Harosheth is over here on the west, almost to the west coast. And then Megiddo is down here, and Tanakh is a little farther down still, mostly on the south edge of this plain. And then up on the north side, we have a mountain sticking out of practically nowhere, Mount Tabor, all sort of like Pike's Peak, sticking out of nothing. Apparently a place where millennia ago a volcano erupted and left this lone mountain. Well, there's an advantage in being on the mountain, and that is from Mount Tabor, you can see the land surface for 50 miles around and probably the air for 100 miles around. You have a good view of the heavens. Whereas if you're down in Harosheth or Megiddo or Tanakh, the Mount Carmel range keeps you from seeing what's going on to the south. So what's happening here? Deborah and Barak can see clearly by looking south that the clouds are forming, and the clouds are coming northward, hidden from the view of Sisera, the enemy of the Lord's people. So what happens? They come down from Mount Tabor to draw the army of Sisera to the Kishon River. And then, pretty soon, up at the headwaters of the river, you get this cloudburst. And the waters are starting, but out of view of Sisera and his hosts of chariots. And then comes the rain. Then comes the lightning and the thunder. And the rain comes, and pretty soon the floods come and wipe the chariots away. So that explains to us why it was that Sisera had to get down off his chariot and make a run for it. The chariots were mired in the mud. Same thing the Lord did at the Red Sea, only they'd forgotten that. That was a couple centuries ago. It was not a small army. From the worldly standpoint, 10,000 Israelite soldiers were facing many, many foot soldiers. They were facing archers, chariots of iron. Pharaoh, in the days of Yannis and Yambres Assis, in the time of the Exodus, they had 600 chariots of iron. And this guy here, he's got 50% more than that. Now, can you imagine? Here's a 3% grade. You're down at the bottom of it, and you've got 900 trucks bearing down on you. What chance do you have? Ah, but this is now the second time that the Lord defeated chariots the same way. They don't do very well. So as soon as the waters come, now you can just see how Sisera is viewing it. I've got these guys exactly where I want. What? Rain? Oh, of all the rotten luck. The rain came, the mud came. A horse by himself may be able to do okay in the mud. A human being can, but a chariot is a stick in the mud. So lightning and thunder and the rains came and swept them all away. And this is the lesson that we're given in the Song of Deborah. Now we want to go into a little bit of looking at the symbolic significances that we have here too. As was mentioned in the previous talk, many of these names of people and cities have meanings. For example, the name of Harosheth, that's not a common word for us, but it means magic. Magic city. Might give us some thought as to what the significance is. Magic is not well looked upon in the scriptures. Sisera, well, he's a Gentile. He's a Caucasian. He's out of place. Sisera doesn't sound like any Hebrew name you ever heard before, or Canaanite name. Maybe more like Cicero. He's got some European background to him. He could have come from Tyre. Tyre is related to Thrace and to the original population of Italy, the Etruscans and so forth. And we come to Deborah. The word means bee, a buzzy bee. And Barak, that means a lightning flash. Well, we can call him Flash for short. For a lot of these, I'll just go ahead and reread this with the meanings instead of the names. And the children of Israel again did that which was evil in the sight of the Lord when Ehud was dead. And the Lord sold them into the hand of Jabin, king of the lowland, that reigned in Hazor, the captain of whose host was Sisera, who dwelt in Magic City of the Gentiles. And the children of Israel cried unto the Lord, for he had 900 chariots of iron, and 20 years he mightily oppressed the children of Israel. Now, Bee, a prophetess, the wife of torches, she judged Israel at that time, and she dwelt under the palm tree of Bee, between a high place and the house of God, in the hill country of the fruitful. And the children of the prince with God came up to her for judgment. And she sent and she called Flash, the son of a delightful father, out of the sanctuary of my wrestling, and said unto him, Hath not the Lord, the God of Israel, commanded, saying, Go and draw unto Mount Tabor, and take with thee 10,000 men of the children of wrestling and of the children of the neighbor. We have a number of things to work with here in trying to understand what's significant to us in more recent times. Whoops. Where do we come and find a lot of magic in religion today? I'd say probably the capital of that is Rome. And we have Sisera. He is not the king. The king is Jabin, king of Canaan. Now, Jabin, he never really comes into the picture at all. We don't see him. Only he's the chief, but his military representative is this fellow, Sisera, from Magic City. And we have lightning. We have our man Flash. And he is the son of a wonderful father? Well, no, that might represent something like the church or something awfully close to it. The Son of the Delightful Father. From the sanctuary of my wrestling. Oh, what would the wrestling be? We can think perhaps of the armor of God, Ephesians 6, 12 and 13. Our wrestling is not against flesh and blood, but against the principalities, against the powers, against the world rulers of this darkness, against the spiritual hosts of wickedness in the heavenly places. Wherefore, take up the whole armor of God, that ye may be able to withstand in the evil day, and having done all, to stand. Or we have in Genesis the 32nd chapter, when Jacob was left alone, there wrestled a man with him until the breaking of day. This is when he wrestled with the angel, and he was given his name, Prince with God, Israel. Now, how about Deborah? She's the one who prompts the action. Well, perhaps she could represent the covenant. A woman frequently represents the church, and perhaps more frequently a covenant. It would certainly be reasonable. And take with the 10,000 men. Does that call to mind Jude, the 14th verse? And the Lord comes with tens of thousands of his saints to execute judgment upon the ungodly and to convince them of the ungodliness that they have done. It would seem that in the account of Deborah and Barak, we have for us a picture of the ending of this present evil world. And if there is one thing that our attention is focused upon, it is that the battle, the victory was won because they were watching the heavens while the enemy was looking only at the earth, only able to see the earthly things. Now, Deborah was from the land of Ephraim, and we'll see a little occasion to look at that again later. There's a second thing that we'll call attention to. In verse 1, and the children of Israel again did that which was evil in the sight of the Lord. That's the usual formula that's given. It's given several places in Judges, but there are three times when the formula is given without that little word again. And the children of Israel did that which was evil in the sight of the Lord. Twice in chapter 2, verse 11, and chapter 3, verse 7, it's talking about things before the oppressors took over in Israel. The only other time that we see this formula without the word again is in Judges, the 6th chapter, and first verse. And the children of Israel did that which was evil in the sight of the Lord. That word again is not there, is it? What does it mean? Well, just to summarize it briefly, it is telling us in this case it is not successive. It's talking about something at the same time. And it does make sense, because after Deborah and Barak's victory, the Lord's people had rest for 40 years. The attackers didn't come against them. And after Gideon, again, the land had rest for 40 years. So we're really talking about two battles that occurred just weeks apart, possibly only days. Now, just before we reach the sixth chapter, it tells about the land having rest for 40 years. And it also tells a little earlier that after, let's see if I can find that quickly, I will. It's the 24th verse, chapter 4, verse 24. And I'll begin with the 23rd. God subdued on that day Jabin, king of Canaan, before the children of Israel, and the hand of the children of Israel prevailed more and more against Jabin, king of Canaan, until they had destroyed Jabin, king of Canaan. The significance of that seems easy enough. Jabin is the one to represent Satan, whereas Sisera is like his chief representative on earth. After getting rid of Sisera, there's still a work to be done. Only it's not the foreigners attacking Israel now. It's Israel going after the foreigners. By the way, we have some records from archaeology as to how these events were viewed by the Canaanites at that time. I'll go ahead and read one of them. We've got just about enough time for that. This is the king of Jerusalem writing sometime after B.C. 1378. It could be 6 months after, or it could be 6 years after, but somewhere around that time. And he's bothered because these foreigners are taking, as he views them, they're taking over the lands round about. And he writes to the king of Egypt for help. And he says, let the king, this is the king of Egypt, let the king turn his attention to the archers, and let the king, my lord, send out troops of archers, for the king has no lands left. The Habaru plunder all the lands of the king. If there are archers here in this year, the lands of the king, my lord, will remain intact. But if there are no archers here, the lands of the king, my lord, will be lost. And this is because of the advances during the time of Deborah, Barak, and Gideon. There are lots of these El Amarna letters, and some of them really tell their own story. And some of the letters tell stories, too. But we come to Gideon. And the Lord delivered the children of Israel into the hand of Midian 7 years. Now, if we were to look at the map of Israel, we'd have Israel here, and we've got the Jordan River over on this east side here, and we've got the Mediterranean Sea over here, and sort of down approximately in the middle we have the Judean Hills. It's a little bit east of the middle. And what's taken place the first time when the enemy and his chariots get mired down, well, that's over here on the west side of the Judean Hills in this plain of Esdraelon. And, you know, the rains came. When the rains come, the archers can't see to shoot their arrows. The chariots get mired down. The foot soldiers are unsupported, and they scatter. But over here on the east side, it's a different oppressor. This is the host of Midian and their allies. It tells us, I think it was the children of Ammon, remember? Ammon was the chief son of Lot, and the capital of Jordan is still named Ammon, even to this day. And then the children of the east, we'd associate them probably more with the Arabs, the nomadic tribes. And the hand of Midian, this is now 6, verse 2. The hand of Midian prevailed against Israel because of Midian. The children of Israel made them the dens which are in the mountains, and the caves and the strongholds. The caves. That's interesting. We read about these caves a little later. Here's the origin of these caves where David spent time when he was having to be a fugitive from King Saul. And we find them again because it was in these caves that the Dead Sea Scrolls of Qumran were hidden. Now, this is the time when they originated, when Midian was heavily oppressing the children of Israel. And the third verse tells what the alliance was. Now we go down a little farther, and we'll recall that Gideon was called by the Lord. We get down to chapter 6, verse 36. And Gideon said unto God, If thou wilt save Israel by my hand as thou hast spoken, behold, I will put a fleece of wool on the threshing floor. If there be dew on the fleece only, and it be dry upon all the ground, then I shall know that thou wilt save Israel by my hand as thou hast spoken. And to make it brief, it was so. And so he says, well, I'm still not as confident as I would like to be. There's a whole host of those guys, 135,000 and then some. But don't let the Lord be angry if I ask that it be the other way around tonight. And it was so. So then Gideon is sure that this is the Lord speaking to him. And we had initially, when he called troops together, 32,000. But there are too many. The Lord says there are too many. So he says, Gideon, anybody that's scared, tell them to go home for now, at least until the battle is won. Well, there were 10,000 remaining. 10,000, that's the same number that Barak had at Mount Tabor. But still, the Lord says, too many, lest the children of Israel say, I've done it by my own hand. And the number was reduced to 300 by deleting those who were not watchful. They weren't afraid. Give them credit for that. But they were not watchful. There are two kinds of people who do come, but for whom the Lord does not have his work reserved. One is the fearful, and the other is the rash. But if we be bold in the Lord's strength and not our own, he is pleased with that. So we'll take a look now briefly at the situation here. There is the river. On the south side is where the Israelite forces gathered. And on the north side, underneath the hill of Morah, is where the Midianite allies were found. And we've got at least 135,000 and more up there. That's an awful lot of people when you're only starting with 32,000 and you wind up with 300. If we look at the river, it's not going to be easy for the Midianites to cross the river. And then there's a larger hill and a smaller hill to the north. So there's three ways into the Midianite camp, from the east and from the west and from the north. Gideon's forces are reduced to 300. And even those are divided up into three camps. Well, it's easy enough to see then. There was one to the east, one to the east, one to the west, and one to the north to block the way of escape. And the Midianites were kind of scared because the Lord gave one of them a dream that things weren't going to go so well for the Midianites. Now, if you had been in the camp of Midian, you'd notice something. I saw 32,000 troops. Next day, I saw only 10,000. The next day, I saw only 300. Where are all these troops? And were there more to begin with than those 32,000 that we saw? And then came the time, of course, when Gideon's forces broke the pitchers, exposed the torches, and sounded the trumpets. And you can imagine the Midianites saying, I think I found the other 32,000. Only they might not have said it quite so calmly. If you were there at the time, you've got the center of the Midianite camp here at the podium, and over here you've got at the periphery, you've got some soldiers out to the end, and you've got them all the way into the center, and then suddenly you hear this terrific crash, and the sounding of the trumpet, and the captain's torches exposed there, And if you're on the periphery of the camp, the thing you're going to do first is run as fast as you can. If you're a little farther in, what you're going to see is all this racket and the torches of the captains and an inrushing army. Who do you suppose those are going to be? And the Midianites and their allies destroyed one another. That gives us a little information on what happens at the end of this age. Is it just the Lord raining down terror by himself, or does he allow the confused nations of this world to destroy one another? Now, among the lessons that we can extract from this, what was it that caused the light to shine? That's right. It was the breaking of our vessels. Our light shines best in self-sacrifice. The light of the lamp burns best when it consumes the oil. I think there's a scripture in Revelation 1:3 that says, the time is at hand. So we'll begin to wrap up a little bit here. But we can see again the typical significance. It says in one of the scriptures here that they rose early in the morning. This would suggest to us the resurrection of the sleeping saints. And so, there's one more thing that we should talk about, and that is Ephraim. After Gideon is successful, the Ephraimites come and say to Gideon, "Why didn't you call us to battle? We're the most important tribe around here. After all, you saw Joshua. He's from Ephraim. Ephraim is from Joseph. He saved Israel and the whole world in Egypt." "Oh, I know, Judah saved Joseph, but he's a tribe far away in the south. Don't bother about him. We're the chiefs around here." And they were angry with Gideon for not having been called. But who called Gideon? It was the Lord. He spoke peacefully to them. After the battle, when they started destroying one another, and then those were escaping, the two chief princes of the four were slain by the Ephraimites, who then were called to battle. And so Gideon says, I'm only in the lowly tribe of Manasseh, from minor part of it, Ebiezer, and really, what have I done in comparison with you who have slain Oreb and Zeb, the chief princes, at the rock? And so they were pacified for the time. We come a little bit later to the 11th and 12th chapters, and things are a little bit different. This is the time of Jephthah, and we'll be brief on him. But Jephthah is called by the Lord and by his brethren who had cast him out. And they are successful in the battle. And so in the 12th chapter, the men of Ephraim were gathered together and passed northward. And they said unto Jephthah, "Wherefore passest thou over to fight against the children of Ammon and didst not call us to go with thee? We will burn thy house upon thee with fire." Nice guys, eh? Who did the calling in the first place, if it wasn't the Lord? And Jephthah said unto them, "I and my people were at great strife with the children of Ammon, and when I called you, you saved me not out of their hand." Who says I didn't call you? You called, but we called, but you didn't come. And now that we've had the success on our own, you want to kill us because now we're looking good. When we get down to the sixth verse, The Lord delivered them into the hands of those that they wanted to kill, and it cost them the lives of 42,000 of Ephraim. How many Bible students are there? 42,000 of the Lord's people were lost because they were out to slay others of the Lord's people, because they were jealous. And what is the lesson for us? One lesson I can extract from it is, from time to time, the Lord may grant us a blessing, an opportunity to witness, an opportunity to help others. Let it not harden our hearts to say, because the Lord has granted me this favor, I should be chief among the brethren. Others don't have a right to do public witness or whatever unless they consult us first. Over 2,000 years of the church's history, many have fallen on exactly that score. You may say, well, that's no temptation for me today. No. Sooner or later, it's likely to be. Who will we listen to? Will we listen to Deborah, or will we listen to Sisera and Jabin, king of Canaan? So, summarizing then, three lessons. First, discern which directions are coming from the Lord, and then let us follow His directions precisely. Second, let us not despise the day of small things. Let's just do our part and tell what the Lord will do. That's our message. Not to tell what we will do, but to tell the people what the Lord will do. The greatest light comes from the breaking of our vessels, self-sacrifice. And third, the lesson of the Ephraimites. When the Lord blesses our efforts today, He does not automatically make us ruler over His people for tomorrow. But as in 1 Peter 5:6, humble yourselves therefore under the mighty hand of God, that He may exalt you in due time.
The Lord bless thee and keep thee. The Lord make His face shine upon thee and be gracious unto thee. The Lord lift up His countenance upon thee and give thee peace. Amen.